Modern Love, the podcast, is made possible with support from Living Proof.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
Living Proof's dry shampoo is so good at absorbing sweat that you can take a spin class and not wash your hair. See for yourself. Use code LOVE at livingproof.com for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. Living Proof. We are the science. You are the living proof. And by Squarespace, the easiest way to create a website for you and your ideas. With 24-hour customer support, you can start today. You get a free trial, but don't forget to enter offer code MODERNLOVE to get 10% off on your first purchase. You should. Squarespace.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. There's one thing that just about every parent I've ever known has said, and I'm including myself here, one same thing. At some point in time, even while we're in the middle of complaining about our kids, someone always stops and says, "But I just cannot imagine my life without them." Sometimes, though, that's exactly what happens. Sometimes because a parent makes a choice. It's never easy and always complicated. As Amy Seek shares in her brave Modern Love essay, Open Adoption, Not So Simple Math, read by actor Sarah Paulson.
I wanted my son to become the kind of person who appreciates the beauty of the world around him. So I smiled when at 6, he asked to borrow my camera in case he saw something beautiful. We were taking a walk in the woods outside Boston, and following behind him, I was surprised by how much he moved like his father. We spent that afternoon showing each other icicles and hollow trees, breaking frozen patterns in the river ice, inching too close to the water to get a better view of the bridge above. When we arrived home, Ben said that the reason he wanted to go for a walk was to spend time with me. It had been 3 months since I last saw him. I smiled sheepishly and stepped into the living room, where the woman who had adopted him 6 years earlier sat reading the newspaper. I spent the evening chatting with her while avoiding direct interaction with Ben for fear I'd show too much affection or too little. Open adoption is an awkward choreography. I am offered a place at the table, but I am not sure where to sit. I don't know how to be any kind of mother, much less one who surrendered her child, but is back to help build a Lego castle. It is a far cry from the moment he was born, when my 23-year-old body seemed to know exactly what to do, when I suddenly and surprisingly wanted nothing more than to admire him nursing at my breast. When after a drugless labor, my surging hormones helped me to forget that I was a college student, that I lived in Cincinnati, that I was passionate about architecture. During those days, I was roused by the slightest sound of his lips smacking, innocent, newborn desire that offered my deepest fulfillment. In the months before I gave birth, when my boyfriend and I were just getting to know the couple we had chosen, I was able to comprehend the coming exchange only on the most theoretical of levels, but it seemed like gentle math. Girl with child she can't keep, plus woman who wants but can't have child. Balance the equation, and both parties become whole again. During those months, my son's mother, Holly, observed that birth mothers have to accomplish in one day the monumental task of letting go that most parents have 18 years to figure out. Days after his birth, when I struggled with letting go, Holly sat with me and cried. For the children she never got to have, for the fact that adoption would bring her joy while causing me pain. And out of fear, she had already grown to love a child I might not give her. I decided to let her take him for a night to see if I could handle it. She drove him to Dayton, Ohio, where she was staying with family, and then called and asked, "Do you want him back? I'll bring him right now." Meanwhile, the men in our lives stood by and hoped for the best. My boyfriend supported the adoption, and though we had broken up, he was there to help me through my pregnancy. We had met in architecture school, never suspecting that 2 years later we would be forever joined as birth parents, composing 111 questions to ask strangers about the most intimate details of their lives. We had a list of qualities we wanted in a couple, basically ourselves, 10 years older. But when we met the couple we would choose, our list fell by the wayside, replaced by an overwhelming intuition that we could trust them. I signed the papers on a hot August day in 2000, sitting at a large conference table with my sister, my son's adoptive parents, and agents from Catholic Social Services. I'd sat there several times before, but hadn't yet been able to say words to relinquish all rights to my son. Every time I was left alone to think, and hours later, was sent home with him. My ex was not there. The birth had made me a different person, and we couldn't pretend that our losses would be the same. My sister had come from China, where she was teaching. She promised that if I kept him, she would move home and help. Her face was glazed in tears, but she stared intently at me as I prepared to sign the papers, as if to assure herself I knew what I was doing. My pen rested at the intersection of two vastly different futures, and I struggled to see into the distance of each. It did not seem that a gesture as small as scribbling my name had the power to set me down one path while turning the other, its entire landscape, to dust. It was such a small gesture, but it was the first sketch of my life without a son. One of the exercises I was given in adoption counseling was to envision the hours immediately after the adoption. What would I do after signing the papers? Pick up the towels that had been tossed in the corner when my water broke? Pack up the extra blankets I'd been given by the hospital workers who touched my shoulder and prayed aloud that I would find the courage to keep my son? I had spent my entire life without a child, but I was newly born that night too, and my old self disappeared. I could no longer imagine how a mother could give up a child and live. Adoption was not simple math. A new mother cannot know the value of the thing she subtracts. It is only through time. When my son turned 4 and I was 27. When he turned 6 and I was 29. When he turns 10 this year and I am 33 and ready for children, that I begin to understand the magnitude of what I lost and that it is growing. The comfort is seeing my son with his family, whom I can no longer imagine him or myself without. He is an earnest child who seems to kick hard to keep his chin above water in the world, but his mother has a certain lack of sympathy that is good for him. When he wants to retreat into his own head, she pulls him back into the refuge of his family and makes him smile. I am ever astounded that I was able to see in her something that would still feel so right so many years later. The greatest proof of her commitment to openness is that she talks about me when I'm not there. When my son was a baby, I was surprised that he always remembered me, even after long stretches when I couldn't visit. When he was 7 and we were playing a computer game, he told me his password was Cincinnati because his mother had told him he was born there. I know that Holly represents me to my son in my absence and always encourages him to love me. Holly jokes that with open adoption, at least you know what the birth mother is doing, that she's busy at school and not conceiving a plot to steal her child back. It's not so with closed adoptions. The birth mother is powerfully absent. But an open process forces an adoptive parent to confront the pain that adoption is built on. And openness for Holly does not mean merely letting the birth mother know about her child. It means cultivating a real love between birth parents and child. This requires exceptional commitment, which may be why some open adoptions become closed in the end. I love Holly for sharing such things with me, sentiments that show she's devoted to our relationship, and not because it is easy for her. And I have told her that a pivotal point in my grief was the moment I was able to say aloud that I wanted my son back, though I knew it was impossible. When I realized that his adoption had been both my greatest accomplishment and deepest regret. And we continually redefine this relationship. I hide certain exchanges, like the time he was 4 and crawled into my arms and said, "Amy, pretend I'm your baby." I made sure no one was looking before I indulged his request, my entire body shuddering at the chance to hold him so close for the first time since birth. I suspect Holly knows about these moments, and when I visit, she tries to help by sending me off with my son for walks in the woods, where we can freely explore my place in his life. When I returned home to New York after my visit, I looked at the pictures Ben had taken with my camera. Fragments of arms and legs, blurry close-ups of leaves caught in ice, too many spinning forest skies. Evidence to me that although he has his father's distinctive gait, he shares my need to grasp and hold on to beautiful things, to document and to somehow preserve them forever. Things he can't possibly keep.
Sarah Paulson, reading Amy Seek's modern love piece, Open Adoption, Not So Simple Math.
In celebration of the Trinity Collection's 100th anniversary, this podcast is supported by Cartier.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with a first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Giving up her son really changed Amy in ways that she's still coming to terms with and ways that really surprised me. We'll hear how after a short break.
I'm Katie at Living Proof, and we get love letters all the time, like this one. Dear Living Proof, I have thick, curly hair that gets big and frizzy. I've spent years trying tons of hair products, and I finally found Living Proof. After just 2 weeks, my hair feels fabulous. I'm back, baby. Love, Pam. You can use the code LOVE for a free travel-size dry shampoo with your $20 order. Livingproof.com.
We're back. It's Modern Love, the podcast. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and you just heard Amy Seek's essay about the tender calculus of an open adoption, a calculus that never quite ends. And Amy Seek joins us now. Thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, also with me in the studio is Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Magma.
So, Amy, your piece really, really, really struck me. It is so honest and so raw. But once it ran in Modern Love, did it have an effect on your relationship with your son's adopted family?
Only in the best ways, I would have to say. I think that we're on both sides battling very primal emotions, and we keep them in check. And we both know that ultimately we are friends, and we won't let those things interfere with the greater good of our relationship with each other and my son.
So what's your relationship like with your son today?
Well, he's a teenager, so it's changing fast.
Yeah,
he's 15, and he's becoming more interested in his own friends and his own world. And I feel that pain of parenthood, that his trajectory is absolutely not going towards me. As much as I feel like the older he gets and the more charming and beautiful he becomes, the more I want to just have him close. But it always surprises me when I visit him. I just recently visited him with, he was doing a running meet with some friends. And I kept saying, you should go and be with your friends. And he continually said, I get to see them all the time. So he's continually affirming his desire for closeness as well, I think.
Dan, there's so much to the story that Amy wrote, but I'm wondering what you found particularly compelling about it.
Well, coming from a landscape architect, which is how she described herself in her cover note, and not a writer, I was just sort of entranced by the writing and how penetrating it was. You know, so often we talk about people when they're young, whether they're in their teens or their early 20s, as making impulsive decisions based on emotion. But it was a rational decision, and this is what will be best for everybody. But then as the years pass, you know, she sort of gains the wisdom of experience and of pain, and sort of coming into that knowledge, it was just a remarkable emotional experience to read.
Yeah.
I think it stirs up a lot of emotions.
It definitely does. What kind of response did you get, Amy, after the piece first ran? Did you hear from people who had read your story?
Yeah, it's always interesting to speak as a birth mother because so many adult adoptees, have contacted me through the Modern Love piece as well as other occasions I've spoken on adoption panels and things, and how I hear from them that they're surprised to know that their birth mother thinks of them. And I'm surprised that anyone could think otherwise. It's not a daily thought in a tragic way, but he's a fact of my life. And I can't fathom forgetting.
Yeah, I'm just wrapping my head around what you just said, that for the child, maybe it's, you know, they think, well, I was given up or I was put mm-hmm. into this other family. So, you know, of course my birth mother doesn't think of me.
And I kind of think it speaks to the asymmetry of the relationship between a parent and a child in any case. It's like the child should always have the luxury of just being loved and not even having to think of it. But in this case where I'm not there, he doesn't have that automatic comfort. But I still have the love.
Why was it important to you to tell your story in such a public way?
Because I think I had heard so many stories of adoptive couples being kind of saviors. And the story was always adoptive couples and then a child who needed a home. And there was this absent member, and I just really wanted it represented. I know so many birth mothers, and we are part of the story. So I knew that I had it in me to tell a story that I think should be told from all birth mothers.
We run some controversial columns in Modern Love that get people stirred up, but no subject gets people more stirred up than adoption.
Really?
And, you know, it speaks to adoption itself. There's no clean way to present it that isn't going to hurt people. And if the adoption story is positive, then we'll receive criticism that you're instilling false hope. And if the story is negative and a child is having all kinds of emotional problems or whatever, then you're scaring people away from that option and presenting it as something people should not do. And really, no matter how we how we approach this subject, it is just a hot button topic that people get very, very upset about.
And I can't fully understand that, but it does strike me as a very inhuman act to give up a child. And it's something that I've had to come to terms with in myself. Like, the deep animal act of letting go of a child shakes something inside you. It changes something. And that's a thing to battle with your whole life.
Have you had any more children?
I have not.
Okay. Have you wanted to?
I have, but it's interesting because I feel like because I've practiced loving my son at a distance, there's a certain way in which I've approached relationships that way that I think I have a certain detachment. But not to say that I don't love people, and I have had great relationships.
It sounds like that's yet another way, I mean, you use the word detachment, that the decision that you made has had a sort of a continuing impact on you.
Absolutely. I do still have days that I think, can someone survive giving up a child? And I think potentially the life that I'm living is not a real life because it's not possible to have a real life after doing something like that. So I'm at this point where it's a little bit now or never for me to have children. And I do have a prospect that I don't want to talk about because it's still in a somewhat early relationship stage. But in the moments when I'm some days hoping really strongly and then some days accepting the possibility that it will not happen. And the really wonderful thing is in those moments when I accept that it might not happen, I really embrace the fact that I do have a child. And I'm really looking forward to continuing to grow as his mother in our particular way.
Amy Seek is the author of this week's story, Open Adoption, Not So Simple Math. Amy is a practicing landscape architect and author of the memoir, God and Jetfire, Confessions of a Birth Mother. Amy, thank you again so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And Dan Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times and author of Love Illuminated, exploring life's most mystifying subject with the help of 50,000 strangers. Dan, thanks for illuminating a very complicated aspect of love again for us today. Thank you.
Thank you, Meghna. It's always a pleasure.
Special thanks to Sarah Paulson, who read this week's essay. See Sarah as Marcia Clark in the upcoming series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, American Crime Story, which debuts on FX on February 2nd. Next week on Modern Love, Judd Apatow brings us the story of a date that ended in the emergency room.
Being wheeled into surgery like this, alongside a woman in a sexy dress, pretty much screamed, sex injury.
Modern Love is a production of the New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Jessica Alpert, John Perotti, and Amory Sievertson. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Music for the podcast, courtesy of APM. And if you haven't already, subscribe to Modern Love on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, write us a review and let us know your thoughts on this week's episode. Now, I've already received a bunch of email from you, so I know what kind of adoration you've got for the column and the podcast. So it's time for you to become a part of Modern Love. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to get your phone or your tablet and record a voice memo. Or if you want, you can write an email and send it to us. This week, we want to hear about your favorite quotation on love. It can be anything, hopeful, thoughtful, wistful, whatever you want. Then you're going to send it to modernlove@wbur.org. That's modernlove, all one word, at wbur.org. Here's one of my faves to get you started. It's from the poet Rainer Maria Rilke. He once wrote, "For one human being to love another, that is perhaps the most difficult of all our tasks, the ultimate, the last test and proof, the work for which all other work is but preparation. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Thanks for listening.